Okay, we are set and ready to go for the third hour of the program. As I told you earlier, the police have arrested three more in Boston. Apparently, three college friends of the Boston Marathon bombing suspect, Zohar Tsarnaev, were arrested and accused of obstructing justice by removing a backpack from the terrorist dormitory room. And so now people from like John Bolton all the way down to the usual anti-terror types are saying, oh, this is evidence of a grand conspiracy. This isn't just a small little cell. They had to have all sorts of Al-Qaeda involvement. And indeed, to be fair, in Dagestan, in Chechnya, there is a great Islamist movement there. Which somebody ought to ask maybe why we're allowing refugee status from that part of the world, but then that would run up against the Gang of Eight and this push to open the borders, so we're not going to do that. But we are going to hail the federal and state authorities for the way they handled Boston, are we not? Well, not everybody. Anthony Gregory is a research fellow at the Independent Institute. His new book is called The Power of Habeas Corpus in America. And in the aftermath of Boston, Mr. Gregory, who indeed has a degree from history at the University of California, Berkeley, says, look, I've got some questions as to whether we should declare martial law, effectively lock down an entire suburb of Boston, and then fail to find the guy who we now find out was actually in the search zone, and then wonder why we didn't connect the dots when the Russians and the Saudis were telling us about Tamerlan Tsarnaev. Where is the government competence here? That's what Anthony and others are asking, and I think it's a pretty good question. Anthony Gregory, welcome to the Jason Lewis Show.
Hey, Jason. It's good to be with you.
Good to be with you. I do want to talk about your brand new book, The Power of Habeas Corpus in America, a tour de force of this, shall we say, common law privilege and immunity developed many centuries ago and now under assault by some, anyway, as you suggest, in America in the midst of this war on terror. But before we get to your book and before we get to that little history lesson, let's talk indeed about Boston. You had written a while ago that you were very concerned about the way this thing was handled, far from lauding the law enforcement authorities for what they did. You thought there was a bit of an overreaction or a bit of a sort of a fumbling here. First, they locked the entire city down, and everybody is quarantined in their homes. Then they let everybody out, and when they let them out, there's a firefight. Is that a fair assessment of some of your concerns?
Yeah, my main concern is that there was this lockdown, which seemed like quite an overreaction. We've seen this militarization and nationalization of our policing for the last several decades.
Yeah, they look like army squads when they arrive now, right?
They do. They often do. You know, you hear the president say that we shouldn't have weapons of war on the streets when he's talking about AR-15s, which are, of course, not weapons of war. They're just normal rifles. But but the police are decked out like they're going to war all the time. But when they locked this down with 9,000 or 10,000 cops and federal officials and troops and, you know, the FBI and everything, they've never really done quite that before. I mean, there have been somewhat similar major crackdowns when there's a huge disorder or, you know, back in the day when there were
the 1968 riots during the Democratic Convention and curfews and quarantine, not quarantine so much, but I can remember curfews at 10 or 11 o'clock, yeah.
Yeah, and there's been stuff like this, but this was, they were in the pursuit of one suspect, and although the crime was particularly vicious and particularly newsworthy and had everyone's attention, it's just
You asked to the point, if the suspect escapes to another city, do they lock down that city? Are we sacrificing all of these civil liberties in the sake of getting one suspect who, as you say, pretty egregious crime, but nevertheless, that hasn't been the traditional way we look for mass murderers. Not Richard Speck, not Ted Bundy, not anybody.
Sure, not the D.C. sniper. They didn't lock down D.C. over that. They didn't lock down Dallas after the Kennedy assassination. They didn't really even lock down New York after 9/11.
So you're saying this is resembling a totalitarian state?
Well, you know, there's gradations here, and of course, there's even within a totalitarian state, there's a spectrum of activity that we could find troubling, all the way from checkpoints to mass extermination. They didn't, you know, commit mass extermination, certainly, but I would say it was a police state type approach to the question.
So in the wake of, I'm just trying to expedite things here, Anthony, forgive me, but in the wake of the suspect, the bombing, let's say I'm in Watertown, and you know what? I want to go out. I'm not going to be cowered by the suspect or terrorist. I want to go out and grab a cup of coffee. I want to go to work. I want to live my life, and I'm assuming the risk. I know he's out there, and I know I could get killed by a mugger, but I'm going to do it. And what you're saying is the individual ought to have that opportunity.
Yes, I do think so. And, you know, for much of the area of the lockdown was quasi-voluntary in that a lot of citizens were allowed to leave but chose not to. Although it's a troubling thing just in itself that the people that did go along with it, because what if there's an attack or a crime of this nature and it warrants this kind of lockdown? I mean, among the many other implications, we must consider the sheer cost, the economic cost. I mean, this probably costs hundreds of millions of dollars in lost business and in government expenditures. So does that make sense? Is that the way you deal with a killer who's killed four people or he's certainly injured many people? But what if in this country we did have an attack like that every month? You know, it'd be terrifying, but would we be in a constant state of siege? And I'd like to point out, when we're weighing the threat, I calculated this. If we had 10 attacks identical to that one every day, you'd still be 3 or 4 times more likely to die in a car crash or be injured in a car crash than in such an attack. So obviously there's a difference between a crime and an accident. But when we're considering...
There's also a difference between crime and war, which is something that's lost on a lot of people. I mean, that is really the fundamental question as to who conducts the war on terror, whether it is done under the auspices of the Bill of Rights, whether it is done in the auspices of confronting crime, or whether it is done, as some would say, under the powers of Article 2 and the Commander-in-Chief and a war. The problem is we haven't debated that. We haven't had a declaration of war, so we have perpetual war and perpetual war powers now, including martial law in cities, as you describe, and that ought to be troubling to any true blue civil libertarian.
Sure, and even, you know, refusing to read his Miranda rights under this public safety exemption.
Right.
This is Obama expanding this exception. The original purpose of this exception is, you know, if you're on site and there might be bombs right there.
Or if you've kidnapped a girl.
And by the way, they justified the lockdown because they wanted to find him and that there were supposedly bombs that were right. Unfound. But they ended the lockdown before they found him or made sure there were no bombs.
Well, it's funny you should mention that, because we've got new information out today on that very point. Did the state and local police really behave in a competent way? More with Anthony Gregg when we come back. Neighbors in and around the area where the police engaged in the wild shootout on April 19th with the two Boston Marathon bombing suspects are now starting to speak out, and they're not happy campers. Indeed, we've had this sort of media narrative from the president on down that the state and local officials, including the FBI, but primarily the state and local officials, did a yeoman's work. The police got cheers. But now some neighbors are saying during the all-day manhunt, the police never searched the Franklin Street homes where they eventually found the living suspect. That indeed the shootout when they killed Tamerlan Tsarnaev was 400 yards or something from where they finally found his brother, and yet that area at Franklin Street was never searched. So during the all-day manhunt, the police never searched Franklin Street homes. 10 other neighbors have confirmed the same story, and they're pretty mad now. And they're starting to speak out and saying, wait a minute, they missed the boat, so to speak, pardon the pun, that you had a situation where the police initially said, well, you know, Tsarnaev, the suspect that survived, was found outside the 20-block area that was supposed to be cordoned off. Apparently not true. Apparently he was found inside. They just missed it. And if it were not for the tip of another man, who I still can't believe wasn't shot because the guy was unarmed, he would have shot him otherwise probably, they may never have found the guy. And this is, as Anthony Gregg, our guest, points out, after they suspended the basically the lockdown, as it were. Anthony Gregg is our guest, and he's looking at the events here and starting to shed a skeptical eye on this as well, or view with a skeptical eye. His book, by the way, which we'll talk about momentarily, his new book just out, The Power of Habeas Corpus in America. And I suspect, Anthony, whether it's being threatened in your mind will come to the forefront here. Anthony is a research fellow at the Libertarian Leaning Independent Institute out west. He's written a number of articles, has a history degree from the University of Cal Berkeley, and gave their undergraduate history commencement speech not too long ago, as I say, his new book, The Power of Habeas Corpus in America. So now we're getting this different narrative that the state and local police, who initially said, oh, we did a great job, thank us, never even searched 67 Franklin Street in Watertown. What gives with that?
Well, I'm not surprised. When I wrote my critique of the lockdown, I actually assumed that the police would be far more competent than it turns out they were. But I'm never surprised at incompetence like this. A lot of people who understand that government has a lot of trouble handling issues like health care and education and so forth, they don't seem to realize it's the same exact dynamics at play with policing and law and order and national security. And so, of course, there was a failure.
I like to say that the same people that designed the stimulus plan are the same ones conducting foreign policy. So if you interventionist foreign policy, you must love the stimulus plan. That doesn't mean that defense isn't the first order of the federal government. It is, and one of the few enumerated powers. It just means it's still a government program.
Yeah, and of course, there's always failure up and down. I mean, remember 9/11 came after massive intelligence failure, but one of the biggest government failures in recent memory. The government was spending $40 billion a year on intelligence, and it missed it. But of course they missed it. I mean, sometimes they might get it right, but there's no profit-loss test. There's no sense of liability. Almost no one ever gets held responsible for failure. The government doesn't have the correct incentives. So there's no reason to ever expect them to do well in this area any more than any other. And so no one should ever be surprised if you find out that, I mean, I remember it took a couple days before it was revealed that he was unarmed when they found him. Remember the first, they got, when they caught him, everyone thought, oh, they went in there and they found this armed terrorist and they somehow brought him out alive.
Mm-hmm.
But what really happened was they went in there, he was bleeding to death in a boat. They shot the boat full of holes, presumably trying to kill him, and he was unarmed. So it's the exact opposite. He was unarmed.
Now, are we to feel sorry? Wait. Are we to feel sorry for this guy that kills an 8-year-old and he gets shot up?
No, I'm not talking about feeling sorry for him. I'm saying that they even try to kill him and they failed.
I mean,
the point is they weren't heroic. They didn't heroically risk themselves to retrieve an armed terrorist alive. They attempted to shoot a guy in a boat that when the neighbor had courageously found there. They went in there and without looking, they thought he was in there and they shot it full of holes and they failed to even, and you know, they didn't even succeed at that. And so it was the opposite of the story.
So you've got a scenario here
that he wasn't a threat to them at that moment.
Let's see if we can connect the dots. We've got a scenario here where we let people into the country, and you may be more libertarian leaning on immigration than perhaps I am. I happen to believe, like Milton Friedman did, that labor ought to be able to find capital, and the governments of any country shouldn't impose that, except that we've got a welfare state that now subsidizes immigration, subsidizes low-skilled immigration especially, and these guys got $100,000 in public benefits while they were here for 10 years. So I don't think you can mix the two. And by the way, neither did Friedman before he died. He said you'd have to eliminate the welfare state before he could adopt his libertarian open borders. That's kind of where I am on immigration. So whether you agree with me or not on that, the fact is we allow them in on refugee status, even though they're from the war-torn Chechnya area, probably living in Dagestan, a hotbed at the time. So instead of keeping the bad guys out, we let them in. Then the government subsidizes them. Then we get warnings from Russia and the Saudis, according to the Daily Mail, that Tamerlan is a real bad apple. You better keep an eye on this guy. We don't. They investigate, drop the ball. He goes back to Russia, probably to the Chechnya area. They don't follow that. Then we get the bombing, and the police cordon off the entire town. You've got a 20-hour fear that grips the entire city, not knowing who's going to get killed next. And they say they're searching this 20-block area, I guess it was. Not 20-block area. Yeah, I think it was about a 20-block area. But they fail to search the area 400-some yards from where the shootout occurred hours before. And then, as you say, they finally get the guy in the boat who was unarmed, but they shoot it up and they get him. I mean, it does sound like one ball dropped after another if you put it all together.
Well, yeah, of course. If you ever trust the government to do anything right, and I make no exceptions, don't be surprised when it fails.
Well, then if that's the case, let's take your point to its logical extent, and I can guarantee you how many emails I'll get tonight from police listeners, and we've got a few of them saying, hey, we put our lives on the line every day. We solve more crimes than you can possibly imagine. You'd be a lot more in jeopardy without our bravery. So are you saying, Gregory Anthony, that, look, or Anthony Gregory, I should say, you're saying that if government can't protect us, then what the heck? What's the use of having it? Let's challenge or go down that road when we come back.
Every time I try to tell you.
You know, a couple of things come to mind analytically or public policy-wise as well as strategically. I can remember, and if Anthony Gregory, our research fellow at the Independent Institute and author of The Power of Habeas Corpus in America, if he's a Cal Berkeley grad, he remembers the Nixon law and order strategy coming out of the 1960s that essentially led the Republican Party down the notion of, well, we're skeptical of government except when it comes to defense and law and order, police. So we'll defund the pensions elsewhere, but we'll support those pensions. And the Democrat Party being the party of public assistance, but weak on defense and crime. And that's always been a false sort of dichotomy, because you're either in favor of government or you're skeptical of government. Doesn't mean you want no government, but it means it must be strictly limited by the chains of the constitutions. And so now what we're seeing is, contrary to conventional wisdom, you're seeing the President Barack Obama, really continue the Bush policies in the Middle East and the war on terror. You're hearing a lot of ranting and raving, but he's actually, you know... unmanned aerial drones without a warrant, killing people. I mean, you may say it's justified, but that's certainly an extension of the policy. So, Anthony Gregory, there's been this false sort of dilemma between, well, do I support this sort of government? It's either, let me put it to you this way. It doesn't surprise me to see the president, the big cheerleader for cops and getting tough on law and order. That law and order liberals are a natural outgrowth of big government, aren't they?
Of course, it was the progressives who invented the modern police force in the 20th century, and Berkeley was one of the big cities to pioneer fingerprinting and the whole modernization that got pushed in all the big cities. And it was the Democrats that in many ways created this drug war and have always favored certainly wars abroad. If you look at war abroad, the four biggest wars in the 20th century were all Democratic wars.
Right.
So...
war is the health of the state.
Yeah, war is the health of the state. And the Republicans expand government in every direction. And Bush gave us Medicare D and No Child Left Behind and the steel tariffs and Sarbanes-Oxley and TARP. I mean, that was the biggest government administration since Johnson until Obama. And Obama, of course, he's going to expand all of the Bush wars and the Guantanamo and the crackdowns on medical marijuana or whatever. I mean, they're both... their rhetoric differs, and their ideology differs somewhat, but
the net result, right.
Yeah, the liberalism today is just about big government with a certain cultural...
yeah, we're debating between the 40-yard lines. That's right. The parties are playing between the 40-yard lines. There's no great extreme. I tend to agree with you on that. And also, however, if indeed the government, in its incompetency, cannot prevent terrorism, cannot prevent crime, for that matter, so the city of Chicago comes to mind, What then? Why have the police force? Are we better off without it? I mean, where does this lead? What conclusions do you draw?
Well, certainly, you know, the United States didn't always have these police forces in the sense that we do. And I would say a lot of the crime, you brought up Chicago, a lot of the crime there is because of things the police do. The drug war, you mentioned Friedman. You mentioned Milton Friedman in different contexts. Well, he also estimated that half of the homicides in the United States were because of the drug war. And then you got to consider what gun control does and disarming people. You got to consider what public schools do. And then when you look at some of these conspicuous acts of violence, like in Boston or Oklahoma City or 9/11, a lot of the time the perpetrator cites specifically government violence. Now, of course, that doesn't justify killing or targeting innocent people, but the government violence begets more violence. 9/11, the Al-Qaeda cited, Bin Laden cited U.S. intervention abroad and Iraq and troops in Saudi Arabia. Tim McVeigh, waged his little attack on Oklahoma City. It wasn't so little, actually. And It was on the 2-year anniversary of the Waco atrocity. And he said the government was at war with the citizens. And he saw it in the Gulf War, and then he saw it in Waco. And so he said he saw himself as striking back. He saw himself as a warrior. And Tsarnaev says that reportedly that he was radicalized. These guys weren't. He was a kid when he came here. He didn't move to the United States as any sort of radical. He got radical here. Radical is not even the right word. He got angry to the point where he was willing to inflict harm. And he said that he was inspired by the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. Now, that, again, doesn't justify anything. But those of us who were skeptical of these wars since the beginning have said, since 9/11, that war is not the answer because you're creating more enemies.
Nothing justifies terrorism, but we ought to look to see what animates it. And that means a change in policy would do much, much better than beefing up a police force and turning the cities into places ruled by martial law. You're going to have to continue to instead. A lot of this, of course, is government begetting government. I mean, you get any particular nanny state rule on a seatbelt being a primary offense, and the first people that testify at the state capitol are state troopers because it's a job security issue. So you've got that sort of rent-seeking involved here, even with law enforcement and defense, to be sure, with contractors. I want to talk about the book a little bit and then go to some calls. Eric, Joe, and Lucinda are waiting, so we'll squeeze in some calls at 1-855-885-3947 for Anthony Gregory. All right, the book, The Power of Habeas Corpus in America, is all about what we call the Great Writ, which in Latin, as I recall, means to deliver the body. And what it says, effectively, is government cannot simply run around, as they were doing during the Revolutionary War to American colonists, and detain people. I think the federal law is 72 hours, if I recall, but it might be shorter than that before a hearing. But they can't run around and detain you without a charge and bringing you up in front of a magistrate to see if they can hold you. So the writ means the government has to deliver the body to the judge, and you have to make certain that due process is followed so they will let you go if they don't have probable cause for an arrest warrant or something of that ilk. I gather, and I have not read the book, but I gather that you're starting to worry a little bit about this great writ going back thousands of years or over 1,000 years as to its, as to our fidelity towards it anymore.
Yeah, well, it doesn't go back quite 1,000 years, but there has been long this principle that the government's not supposed to detain people in England and then in America, not supposed to detain people without a judge being able to question the legality of that detention. Now, and it has been, this principle has been compromised in the last 12 years or so. Right after 9/11, they rounded up over 1,000 immigrants and in many cases detained them for months without anything resembling due process.
Well, I mean, Roosevelt and Japanese internment camps.
Sure, internment. There are all of these cases where the underlying principle that we like to ascribe to habeas corpus is certainly being compromised. Now, my book, however, is a little bit revisionist because the more I researched it, the more I realized that habeas corpus was never quite all it was cracked up to be, and we can we need to appreciate the due process rights of prisoners, and we want to make sure that people are in prison are not being held in prison unjustly. But as it turns out, habeas corpus is another government power. It's a judicial order. It's a government program technically, and consistent with what I said before, I found that even something as revered by civil libertarians as habeas corpus is not a clear cut, perfectly working, flawless instrument.
Article 1 says the privilege of the writ of habeas corpus should not be suspended unless when in cases of rebellion or invasion of the public safety may require it. There's your loophole for right. A district attorney to argue and tell his police force, look, don't worry about Miranda. You've got a public safety exception here. Or this is a rebellion. I mean, you know, it used to be that we had a voluntary compact until, quite frankly, Lincoln said, well, no, actually, we have a perpetual compact, and anybody talking about secession is now in violation of well, they're treasonous. They're rebels. And therefore, we don't have to worry about habeas corpus or anything else. We can jail sympathizers. So there are these massive loopholes. But in the final analysis, doesn't it come down to what I said earlier as to whether the authorities view something as a crime or a war?
Well, that's part of it. One thing that they do with that they've been doing since 9/11 is they want to have it both ways. They want to treat it like a crime, the ultimate crime of terrorism, so they don't have to, for example, give prisoner of war status to people detained at Guantanamo. Many of them, right. By the way, weren't belligerents. But they also want to deny criminal justice protection. So they want to
hold that thought. We're up against a hard break, but you're talking about unlawful enemy combatants. We'll pick it up on the other side. Okay, I do want to squeeze in a couple of calls for Anthony, but before we do, a real quick summary on this sort of middle ground. You're quite right about that. An unlawful enemy combatant is someone that doesn't have the due process rights of a civilian defendant because they are indeed not engaged in a crime but a war. And yet, because they don't have a uniform on, have not taken up the Geneva Convention or the codes of another army, they're not protected by the international rules of war, so they're in limbo, so essentially we can do what we want. And some say, ex parte Kieran and others say, look, there's a long history of prosecuting unlawful enemy combatants and military tribunals.
There is a history, but you know, even Justice Scalia referred to ex parte Kieran as not the court's finest hour. That was it's widely viewed as an embarrassment. The point that you make, though, is an important one. That we basically have what many have called a legal black hole, where the state wants to treat it as war or as a crime, depending on what's more convenient for the state. And that's not the way it's supposed to work.
Why don't we just have a congressional debate? And there is a question as to whether you can declare war on an organization, but whether or not, have a full-out congressional declaration of war and give the president the powers constitutionally, if that's what we want to do. And if the Congress decides not to do that, then prosecute these people in civilian court and treat terrorism as a crime. Make it black or white one way or another.
Well, Congress doesn't want – most Congress – members don't want to do that because then they would have to own up to their decisions. I mean, one reason that they didn't, you know, officially declare war in Iraq, but rather pass that resolution
right.
in the fall of 2002, giving the choice to Bush, was because they wanted to be able to say, "Hey, this wasn't our decision. This was the president's." It's expecting far too much from our Congress members,
right.
to expect them to be honest and meticulous about a mere matter of life and death.
So where does, and let's get to this question and get to some calls, two calls from Eric and Lucinda. Where does habeas corpus play into this? Quickly.
Well, habeas corpus is the ability of a judge to look into a detention to make sure, it's lawful. It's really just kind of a bare bones minimum of due process. But it's been effectively gutted through congressional statutes, through court decisions, through executive fiat. And that's been the case for hundreds of years. The powers that be have always found a way to get around it. It looks good on paper, but, you know, I once was told that, you know, gun control laws don't work very well, and neither do law control laws.
Well, but then what's the answer? I mean, if you can't have a constitution that enumerates and limits government power, and the constitution doesn't work, what does?
Well, whatever the Constitution says doesn't matter as long as the people put up with tyranny, right? So, in the end, you could argue for the virtues of an enumerated powers doctrine, but, you know, the Constitution, Bush reportedly called it a goddamn piece of paper,
and
there's some extent to which that's true, that really what matters is the Constitution in the hearts and the minds of the people. And if the people believe in liberty, then everything else will follow. If the people believe in statism and tyranny, fascism, totalitarianism, then that's what we'll have. And that's one reason the state likes to control the schools and to have influence in media
Didn't Bomadine v. Bush reinstate some particular aspect to habeas corpus, or was that undercut and hamdy?
No, Bomadine did, in fact, in a sense, it went further than anything else did in declaring that there was a constitutional right of habeas at Guantanamo.
Right.
But the executive branch soon enough found a way to circumvent that. I mean,
How did they do that?
Well, all that it does, it really guarantees, is that a judge will look at the case, but then, you know, a higher judge can always overrule and send someone back, or the president can, you know, in the end, it's like Andrew Jackson said about the Trail of Tears when the Supreme Court said you can't do that. He says, you made your ruling, now enforce it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Lucinda in Blaine, you're on with Anthony Gregory. Hi. I'm sorry, I'll get you up here, Lucinda. Go ahead, dear.
Are you there?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, good guest. Interesting questions. I'm wondering if you might know, one of the things that bothered me about the Boston situation just didn't seem right was how they lost this guy in the night, how they weren't able to track him knowing that he jumped out of a car and ran. Now, maybe the cops lost him, but I would think that the police dogs could have tracked him. And if not, they had half the night and the whole next day to get bloodhounds in there. So it just doesn't seem right to me that they lost him and had to do this lockdown. Do you have any answers
any
to that?
Thoughts on that, Anthony?
Nothing that specific. Just my basic, you know, I'm never surprised when they fail. Just pretty much never.
There's more to this than meets the eye because it's true, Lucinda. We were told the guy was in the boat armed. We were told he was outside the search zone. Both of those things turned out to be totally false.
Hmm.
So it is.
Well, and the other thing is, you know, I don't want to say that everything they say is not true, because then you end up believing all kinds of absurd stuff. But you can't believe anything you hear about this on its face, especially in the first day or few days. It takes the time.
That's true.
You know, there's always confusion on the first few days.
Lucinda, thank you. Eric in Medina, welcome to the program. Hi.
I talked to you the night that this was going on, and it was about the time where they were just about ready to call it off.
Yeah, and you were pressing. You actually made these cases.
Well, I mean, and I have biases, but in this case here, I'm looking at the coverage, and I'm saying to myself, you know, geez, this is really overreach, and yet it hasn't produced any results. Now, that state in particular has neutered their population. You can't have guns. Mm-hmm. So only the stateies and the BPD and all these other, you know, named agencies have the power, and yet they turned out to be completely paralyzed and impotent.
And it weren't for the guy that gave the tip. And you made the point that night, as I recall, Eric, that typically it was Massachusetts.
Yeah, I mean, that's my, where I think people, I talked about it, you know, they could have been better off just asking Ben Affleck, you know, how to find the guy. And when they go ahead and go through all this exercise, and then at the end of the day, it turned out to be a citizen.
Well, I got to say, I was kind of hard on you that night, too, Eric, and you were probably closer. You may turn out to be closer to the truth, you and Anthony Gregory, than the rest of us. Anthony Gregory's new book is called The Power of Habeas Corpus in America, Tour de Force of the Great Writ. Anthony, thanks so much.
Thank you very much. It's been my pleasure.
My pleasure as well. Folks, back here tomorrow. See you then.